I would like to begin by picking up from yesterday, where I had attempted to sketch out at least the modern typical view of how the universe came into being. And now to say, in my own way, how I would try to express my faith in God in relation to that story. I think, first of all, that it has been made easy for us in some respects because there are certain parallels with the biblical story. That, for example, creation seems to start from a single point in time and to develop over a period of long ages, and that there will also be in some way an end, either that finally the universe will expand to the point where it kind of dissipates out into randomness in all directions, or it will come back like that ball that has been thrown high and now begins to recontract and come back together into some primitive fireball again. But in either case, we have a kind of a span of history there, which relates to the biblical concept of a beginning and an ending. But I'd like to begin not with the universe for a moment, but with Mozart. And I'm not going to sing for you. Huh. Very interesting, though, the way music and astronomy and physics have gone together. Little known fact is that Kepler, who discovered the laws of planetary motion, as soon as he had worked out the figures, the statistics for the length of the time that it took Mercury, for example, the planet Mercury, to circle the sun, and the variation in the orbit, that is whether the orbit was perfectly circular or elliptical, as soon as he had worked this out for the planets he knew, he immediately set them to musical notation. For those of you who are fascinated by such things, and I imagine there's two of you here who are, what he did was to say, well, there's Mercury, and it goes around very fast, so it has a very high frequency, so it'll be a high tone, and since it has an elliptical orbit, somewhat irregular orbit, that tone will vary considerably. When he gets to the planets with more circular orbits, like, let's take Jupiter way out there. Jupiter, since it goes around very slowly, takes a matter of many, many years to make an orbit around the sun. It has a very low frequency and a very little variation in tone. So he worked all this musical notation out for the planets. Now, as you know, Holst has a composition called The Planets, where he does a modern composition on it. But there have been some, you know, there's always somebody with a computer. And they've taken Kepler's notations now and worked out the frequencies and the variation in pitch and have a 45 RPM record out, which lets you hear what Kepler's music sounds like. And one man who heard it said, it's pretty boring because you have this high shrill thing going woo, 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 like a siren, and then you've got these big low hums that sort of drone along. It's kind of like listening to a combination of a bagpipe, a buzzsaw, and a siren with other intermediate planets going on for the whole length of the 45 RPM record. He said it may enchant some. He didn't find it very exciting. Why I mentioned that was all parentheses, huh? Mozart, we're going to try to talk about, not Kepler. But one of the fascinating things about a great composer is how she or he can take a very little bit of material. Like Mozart could take a theme, a very brief theme, and perhaps a pattern of notes or time, and then begin to play with those. And the artistry of Mozart in his string quartets, for example, is that he can take just these few musical ideas and invent almost infinitely upon them. And it is delightful. It is not boring. It is not sameness. But it is indeed, the complexity is beautiful, and particularly when you know that it comes from such simplicity. Now, that's by way of saying that for me, when I look at the universe, what I see in it is the same kind of complexity out of some very simple stuff. And thus, the universe becomes, in all of its intricate pattern, a magnificent variation on four simple themes. And these themes are the four forces which govern the relationship of matter. The two of them are so infinitesimal in the sense that they work on such a microscopic level, we hardly ever meet them or know much about them. But the electromagnetic force we're all familiar with everything from light to x-rays, and then the force of gravity. Now, the beauty of contemporary science is that they are searching for a unified theory which will relate these four forces to one another and make them all kinds of special cases of one grand mathematical theory. The thing that makes this possible, of course, is the fact that, as Einstein told us long ago, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. Now, that doesn't have to trouble those of you who don't like that kind of stuff. Many of you got out of high school relieved that you didn't have to take any more languages, and the rest of you got out relieved that you didn't have to take any more math, I suppose, except for that large group who were relieved because they didn't have to take any more history. I mean, a lot of those. Whenever a student discovers I teach history, they immediately tell me whether they liked or disliked history in high school. And the dislikes usually run about 4-1 over the likes. It always gives you a challenge to teach history to people who start out by saying, I never liked history. So for those of you who don't like math very well, I'm with you on that. All we need to remember is that this equation, and I put the value of C in miles per hour, 186,000. That's pretty fast.
Per second?
Yes. Thank you, scientist president. Just put that per second there. Anyway, very, very fast. So it's a very large number. When you square it, of course, it's very, very big. What that says is that a lot of energy is equivalent to a little matter. Or when a little matter is decomposed or split into its component energy, a great deal of energy results. So it takes a lot of energy to make a little matter, and it takes a little matter to generate a lot of energy. Okay? But what's important here is simply this interchangeability. Because what I see then in my concept of creation is that you can say in the beginning was God, or before the beginning was God, maybe even better. And that God then takes the word. And we think of word as sound waves. The word is simply some pressure waves that go out. Okay? That's a form of energy. You can just say, well, God then takes energy or creates energy, and using these four laws, these four forces, is able, if I can use this analogy, to knot that energy into particles. First, little things like electrons, and little bigger things like protons and neutrons. And then you've got atoms, and then you can start building all kinds of other things, including all the elements that we know, out of that very simple beginning. But God, you can say he starts with a word which is both energy and order, because the word logos, you all know that, has a kind of double meaning. It can mean word, it also can mean structure. So God has just those little bits of things to work with, energy and these four forces. And by mixing those together, presto changeo, you get a universe which is so immense and magnificent that we can never comprehend it. But it all comes from knotting that matter into bits, knotting that energy into bits of matter. And so it all gets started. Now, the course of nature, though, as we know it, is that everything's running down. You know, that's why we can't have perpetual motion machines, because there's always a little friction, a little heat escapes, and that takes energy off the system, and gradually everything is kind of running down. You all feel that way, don't you? This time, you know what it is. It's like a sandcastle. I don't know whether any of you have ever had the... there are so many Midwesterners here, I don't know what you do. About sandcastles. Growing up on the Pacific coast, my great delight was to make what we call drip castles, where you take the wet sand and you could hold it, squeeze it in your fingers, and it would drip down, and the water would drain away and would leave the sand in intricate forms, and you could make arches and cathedrals and all kinds of things. But you've seen other sand castles, many varieties. You know what happens to them eventually. As the sun beats down and they dry out, they begin to crumble, and they gradually disintegrate. Good word, huh? Disintegrate, fall apart. And in some way, that is the course of nature, entropy, from going to greater and greater randomness and sort of all dissipating out. But now, the Creator God does not only provide the start and the great symphony out of such simple forces, but somehow along the way, He also now takes this knotting business of His and begins to build complexity up out of this general decline of the dissipation of energy. At least in the system we know, the concentration of energy and matter becomes so great that you get life. Now, you know what happens when you boil water. You put enough energy into the water and it gets hotter and hotter, but then it sits there for a while, and those of you who had physics more recently than I have know there's a certain amount of energy that you've got to put in before that temperature will be great enough for the water suddenly to become steam. It's called the heat of something or other. And you have the same thing when it freezes. It goes from the liquid to the solid state. So somehow, in my mind, God, in a sense, compacts, builds up energy to the point where there's enough to move to a new state. So you go from the inorganic state to primitive plants, and life is possible, because living creatures concentrate energy and organize it in a much more complex way than the crystals that live in, that form these mountains and all the rest of inorganic life. So you come to a new plateau, the plateau of life. And so life becomes more complex. And against the general course of nature going the other way, God seems to have pushed along a counterforce, a countertrend, which is that there will be greater structure, greater order, greater complexity. And finally, that structure reaches the point of the human brain. The most complex and orderly part of the universe. There is no more complex array than the human brain. 10 billion cells arranged so similarly in your head and my head and everybody's head, 10 billion of them arranged in such an orderly and compact fashion. First of all, they're all in that little space, but so orderly and compact that communication is possible and that brains work the same way. I mean, someone has said that a brain is a fast, cool-running, fairly long-lived computer mass-produced by amateurs. The human brain becomes then, you see, the most complex and most ordered pinnacle of this process. And thus it makes possible a new level of existence. Now we've had life versus inorganic, and now we have consciousness versus life. And with consciousness, we come to humanity. Because in my understanding, the creation of man, or humanity, occurs at that point where language becomes possible. So there we become truly human and present to ourselves and to the rest of the world all the riddles, all the mystery that is part of being human. Now, just to recapitulate that a moment in a little different way. I'm going to learn something. Learn something every day. When you take off one of these things, all of us. Okay, the first mystery that human beings face is our relation to nature. Within the last few years, the fossil bridge between various primitive forms of life and human life, the fossil bridge has come closer and closer to joining. There are still links missing. There's still about 6 million years in there that they haven't worked out. But when you think of how random our knowledge of fossils is and how few examples we have, such a gap is not unimaginable. Now, there are those who say, well, you're never going to find that gap. I would suppose that we will be able to fill that in, because already in many other ways we have discovered through our chemical composition of our bodies, for example, the cells that are in us are very similar to those cells that are in many creatures. The structure of our body is similar to other of God's creatures. It's clear that we are in many ways like the rest of nature. And yet, we are different, and we differ in some significant respects. One investigator has listed four of these important categories that mark us off from the rest of the 4,230 species of mammals that exist, to say nothing of all the other kinds of creatures we have, insects, and so on. The first of these is complexity. Now, it's interesting that complexity has seldom ensured survival. In fact, the more complex creature, is, the less likely it will be able to survive. The smaller and simpler forms of life are the ones that have lasted the longest and have spread farther and have gone through more dramatic changes in the history of the earth. The plant kingdom, for example. They don't have nerves, they don't have muscles, and yet they are much more dominant in terms of numbers of species than any other living beings, bacteria being included among the plants. Our greatest competitors, humanity's greatest competitors, and maybe one day inheritors of this earth, are not other mammals, by the way. We will not be taken over by the rodents. They're the most numerous of the mammalian species. Order, but we will probably be taken over by the protozoa, the bacteria. They are the viruses. They are our greatest competitors and will probably outlast us. But in addition to complexity, we also have the power intentionally to change our environment, which means that we are not quite at the mercy of the environment the way the dinosaurs were. We can move farther, we can air condition ourselves, we can bring oil from Alaska, and we can even change the quality of our air by putting junk in it if we want to, create a greenhouse effect. We can intentionally alter our environment, and thus that helps us a little bit to meet the changes that nature may bring. Another difference, of course, is self-consciousness, and I want to talk more about that later. Again, a mixed blessing. To be self-conscious means that we can draw pictures of ourselves, we can make poetry, we can meditate on our own existence, but we also can, it can lead to war, to suicide. And self-consciousness, thus, is a kind of mixed blessing. But the final one, and I know you can't read it in the back, improved response to changes in environment. It goes along with intentional change, but this says that more than any other creatures, we are able to respond to changes in environment. And that happens because of that computer of ours, that brain. This is probably the greatest difference from other creatures. And that is that human beings are mentally and physically most equipped for variety in response to the environment. The human hand, for example, is not specialized in the way that a dog's paw is. A dog's paw can do two things well. It can run well and it can dig. Or a monkey's hand, which is very good for swinging from trees and holding on to things. That's great. But the animals have a very specialized use of their hands or paws, whereas ours is not adapted for a single task or even cluster of tasks. Our hand can do anything from supporting us in a handstand to working out the fingering on a flute. Similarly, our brains are not pre-wired. That is instinctual. It's remarkable what instinct can do. Termites, for example, are pre-wired to the point where they can build a termite hill that will have arches inside, will have an interior air conditioning system that will allow air to flow through, will have fungus gardens where food can grow for the termites. All of this done simply because the termite's nervous system works in such a way that a termite, when it sees a certain or senses a certain thing, reacts in a certain way. And so arches can be built and a marvelous architecture developed. Now, you know, that's better than a lot of us because they do that, building a symmetrical structure, even though they've never had a blueprint or a building committee or have studied engineering. Human babies, on the other hand, require years of education and care before they're able to fend for themselves, and most of them will never be able to build a house that would stand up unless they had taken a lot of courses beforehand. Okay? That means that we need a long period of education. The reason we do is that our brain is not pre-wired. We are open. We have the possibility of variety of responses. And it's precisely because there are so many alternatives possible that it is necessary for us to educate our young, to communicate to them which of the alternatives are useful and helpful. And it takes a long time to do that. By the same token, this generalized intelligence, the intelligence for variety rather than for instinctual response, permits us to alter our environment much more profoundly than termites can. Termites cannot change their environment. Humans, though, can create an environment. We can shape our own world. And this openness, then, becomes one of the peculiarly human configurations for problems and characteristics that we'll be talking about the rest of today. It's no accident that the first modern anthropologist, the first modern person to study humanity, was a theologian, J.H. Herder, in 1784, because he meditated on this question, what really are human beings like, and how do they differ from each other, and what do they have in common? So, our relation to nature, just to sum it up. On the one hand, we are enormously vulnerable, sensitive, and dependent on our environment. We are very high on a limb of the evolutionary tree. And while the view is great from up there, the perch is fairly precarious. We are vulnerable to our environment, whether it's physical or emotional. I mean, I don't think animals will normally get a nervous breakdown. We can create a nervous breakdown situation for an animal within a laboratory. That's because we know what we're working toward, and we can get them to do that, to imitate the same thing that happens to us. But naturally, because we're open to alternatives, we are vulnerable to our emotional and physical environment. But on the other hand, we are not only vulnerable, but we are able to change, shape, and create the world around us. And this tension between vulnerability, that is dependence, and transcendence, the ability to change, makes for us some specific mysteries. Let's just look at a couple of those. Let's go back to that business about self-consciousness. What does it mean to say that we are self-conscious? Currently, there's going on a debate about the brain, and it's the question of the relation between the physical structure we've got in our heads and what we call mind, thinking, or consciousness. And in terms of the things we've said earlier, it really involves the extent to which human beings are dependent on natural processes. This case would be the electron state of our brain, or to what extent we control or use our brain the way a scientist uses a computer. And this issue has been called the brain-mind problem. Let's just look at it for a minute, see what it involves. What's going on inside those heads, those of you who are conscious at the moment? Even those of you who are not, it's going on in there too. 10 billion cells. Now those 10 billion cells are not just sitting there waiting for some message to come through. The strange thing we've learned about the brain is that cells are always firing in there. It's like a giant signboard, as they have at some of the ballparks, you know, where they can flash up any kind of thing. But instead of that, the brain, you must think of that same big electronic signboard with lights flashing seemingly all the time, sometimes a pattern flitting across. But think of those 10 billion cells sending cascades of impulses to each other, interrelating, involving more or less extensive areas of this great cerebral cortex that is our scoreboard up there in our head. And this screen continually flickers, ever-changing patterns chase one another with blinding speed across it. The brain thus is receiving at the same time sensory input from fingers, ears, and all the senses we have, and internal message systems. I'm feeling hungry, I'm a little tired, I'm wondering about getting home, I wonder how long this speech is going on. All those things are happening at the same time. Even when we're asleep, most of them go on. This carnival in our head never stops until that ultimate physiological catastrophe we call brain death. But why are we not driven wild by this never-ending New Year's Eve in our heads? There is some mysterious spotlight called attention that lets us consider one group of stimuli at a time. It plays over this welter of nerve endings and allows us to concentrate on a single pattern of related events. As you hear this, for example, your mind is screening out forest sounds, some of the ripple of activity in this room, so that you follow what I'm saying. But the moment I tell you there are forest sounds or flutter of activity in this room, you hear them, because they've been there all the time. And as soon as you're reminded of them, you can flick on that screen and pay attention to those noises. Your ears, though, were picking it up all along and faithfully transforming it into neural impulses that were going into the brain, and it was all there. Deep within the brain, however, the phone had been ringing, but your attention was on another line, and it just didn't answer. What process, we can ask, what process decides which stimulus to pick up? So the question of attention leads to the related question of deciding, volition. This seems to represent a flow in the opposite direction from the incoming stimuli. Here all this stuff is pouring into us, but somewhere deep within me, I decide to write a letter, to watch television, to turn off the speaker, or to listen. This simple act of deciding forms the mysterious root for that concept we call freedom. I may do this or I may do that. And if it's only, you know, D if it's only predetermined because my electron state is in a certain sense, the batteries are higher on this side, and the electronic charges force me to listen to this or that, then there's no responsibility. I'm not responsible for anything. It's just whatever my batteries, whatever my voltage levels happen to be at a specific time. We don't act that way. We don't think that way. There seems to be a center, a self, a consciousness, which is more than the sum of all the inputs that we get. Karl Popper, in a book called Objective Knowledge, has called this domain World 2, in contrast to the physical world of material things. And he says the material world is a kind of necessary but not sufficient cause for what's going on in my head. There must be something else there, some focus of attention, more than just the brain itself. So once again, we come back to the question of dependence or transcendence. Is my self-consciousness simply dependent on electronic impulses, or is there some transcending freedom that allows me to pick and choose among many of the sensory inputs? Well, connected with this whole question of self-consciousness is the use of language. For me, language is what makes us human. There is a debate going on right now as to whether apes can be trained to talk. And the latest round in the battle is that they probably are not using language the way we are, even though they can be taught to respond by punching certain buttons and so on to say, I want banana pudding, for example, or I think you're lousy. They can do all that kind of thing. But the question is whether this is really language or simply a kind of Pavlovian structured response. Most people see speech as a quantum jump in the evolutionary process. That is, a whole new level is reached. And I think we can illustrate that if we think what happens when you are able to speak. Language becomes the key to open up the world as a world of objects. If you name something, you give it a new existence. For example, in this country we have maybe 4 or 5 words for rain. You know, you've got mist and drizzle and light rain and downpour and maybe rain cats and dogs. Yes?
Shower.
Spritzing. That's, I think, another downpour, cloudburst, so on. Something. But there are countries where it rains so much that they have 11 and 12 words for the kinds of rain. Well, if you have that many, you can discern the difference. We say it's drizzling, and you've got just a general old drizzle. Well, there may be actually 3 kinds of drizzle. And to identify by the word, you discover and see that the world around you is more complex because you've given a new word to it. Just as those of you who know something about wildflowers suddenly discover that there are really many more varieties than the persons who flip by in the car. They see, you know, yellow flowers and blue flowers and some white ones, and they say, aren't the flowers pretty? But when you begin to know them by name, they take on an existence of their own. So language begins to name things, and as it names things, they become more real. They spring out of the background, so to speak, and take on a three-dimensional shape of their own. Well, if this is true of objects around us, then, of course, it's also true of ourselves. That language begins to help us differentiate ourselves from other people. Language, the word, thus becomes really the creator of individuals and allows us to begin to talk about God, for example. It frees us from the world we see and know at the moment. We can recall, we can recreate for another person an entire scene. You know, do you remember our 15th wedding anniversary? And then, with a few words of the event and the location, a whole flood of images comes back, and the past is recreated by language. One is thus not limited to the present anymore, but language allows us to move to the past, or even to conceive of a new future. A politician, for example, who gets up and makes campaign promises is, in a sense, painting a picture of a reality which does not yet exist. It never exists. But could exist if now the politician remains true to the promise or to the platform, and the individuals assist in the achieving of it. A goal, a reality, is devised by word, and thus the environment can be changed, and we can do things that we can call into existence things that have not yet existed. Now, of course, once one begins to have language, then one begins to be able to conceive that the world might not be the way it is. I suppose without language there is only the immediate and the present. But as soon as you have language, you can ask questions like, you know, why is this and why not that? Why are things the way they are and not another way? And when that happens, we begin to ask the question of creation. How did these things come to be? They didn't have to be here. I can imagine that they don't exist. So the question of creation becomes a problem for humanity. Or the question of evil, because the not that says, why do things have to be this way? Why couldn't they be better or different? And so we judge a certain state as being evil. Now, certainly animals experience pain or fear, but they don't mark it as evil because they know nothing else. I mean, it hurts. They might say ouch or whatever their equivalent is, scream or yip. But they don't see it as a problem. They don't say, why did God permit mosquitoes or whatever the issue might be. So when one begins to speak, one becomes then a questioner of God, but also a believer, because it is language that permits us to say there is a God behind all of this. There is a creator. But also, of course, it creates the question of ourselves. Why are we here? Who are we? And I'd like now to look at that mystery for a minute. I think we only got two more sheets there, folks. So. Mystery of the self. I want to compare two statements, one of them written in 1940 and one in 1974, and they're about the self. First by a psychologist named Sherrington. Each waking day is a stage dominated for good or ill in comedy, farce, or tragedy by a dramatis persona, the self. This self is a unity, the continuity of its presence in time, sometimes hardly broken by sleep, its consistency of viewpoint, combined to give it status as a unique existence. It regards itself as one. Others treat it as one. The law and the state schedule it as one. All its diversity is merged in oneness. The self, the individual, the me. Now from Joseph Heller's book, Something Happened, 1974. I have a universe in my head. Families huddle there in secret, sheltered places. Civilizations reside. The laws of physics hold it together. The laws of chemistry keep it going. I have nothing to do with it. No one governs it. Foxy emissaries glide from alleys to archways on immoral, mysterious missions. No one's in charge. I am infiltrated and besieged, the unprotected target of sneaky attacks from within. Things stir, roll over slowly in my mind like black eels, and drop from consciousness into inky depths. I'd find 1,000 me's. Well, now, which of these describes the self? Both are true. Both recognize oneness and diversity, and yet their emphases are opposite. The former opinion is the usual interpretation of Western philosophy. That is, there's an individual, and the individual is responsible. There's a self, a central ego with power to control, synthesize the conflicting impulses within us, sort of a a captain up there in the head, you know, looking out through the eyes, steering the big ship and pulling the levers and keeping everything going. That's the self. And with education and homiletics, we direct our attention to that self so that a better, more socially acceptable behavior pattern will develop. It's the target of our actions. The most significant contribution of Freud to the science of his day was the concept of a complex self, which was not always under the rational control of that little steersman up there whom he called the ego. Ego, Latin word for I, self. Since Freud, of course, there have been a host of alternate theories and competing therapies, but they all have a common presupposition. The self, instead of being one, is manifold. Freud encouraged us to listen to these complex voices of the self, to hear contradictory, confused messages from all of the parts of me, and say that they were all somehow the self. He developed, you remember, the threefold concept of ego, superego, and id. The ego, that's the I, that's the self. The id, the Latin word neutral, the it, that is something down there previous to the me, the self, the drives of the body itself, very often. The superego, someone has described the superego as that part of our personality which is most easily dissolved in alcohol. And basically means the whole script from the parents from the past. Those of you who are familiar with other kinds of psychological terminology, this would be the parent. The structures that society puts in us, the tape recorder that tells us what we ought and ought not to do. It's the product of education, training, and so on. Now, Freud said, of course, that we have this variety, and many other psychological theories have come along, and they've had different structures. They've added or taken away. Jung has more parts to the self than three. Others have less. But the question remains, are there not really several me's? Maybe a thousand. Now, the multiplicity of the self has always been fascinating. Why are people different? This has long fascinated people, and the ancients said the reason we are different is that indeed there is a multiplicity within us. There are four humors, as they called it. And the humors didn't mean funny things. They meant that there were four fluids. Everybody was constructed of certain supplies of four fluids, and they named these. One was blood, one was phlegm, one was something which they called cholera, and then there was black cholera. So you have four personality types. Sanguine people, that's the ones in which the blood fluid is dominant. They are no brave. Phlegmatic people, that's where phlegm, which was cold and deadly, and I mean dull. Phlegmatic people are sort of bumps on logs. Choleric people, cholera, that was something that they felt would make you angry. Choleric people were impulsive. And then melancholic people, this black cholera in them, they of course had kind of black moods all the time. They were down most of the time. Well, these were the pure types. But then of course within them you had all kinds of mixtures. That's why people were different. They said it was because you have different mixtures of these humors. Well, then the next or another alternative was to say, no, it's not what's in us that determines our personality. It's our environment that does it. It's the stars that do it. And the whole astrological culture was developed about the idea that since everybody was born under a certain arrangement of the planets, one or more of these planets would be dominant. And so, for example, if you were born under Jupiter, you would be jovial. If you were born under Saturn, you would be Saturnine. If you were born under Mars, you would tend to be Martial. If you were born under Venus, you would tend to Venery, which is a bad word. We don't use it much anymore. But in other words, Mercury, you know that one, people still have mercurial temperaments. So those personality traits came into our language. But I mention it only to show that in order to try to explain the riddle of personality in the past, there have been really two schools of thought. Those who said it comes from within, the humors, today we would call those the glandular people, I guess. No, said it's all a matter of body chemistry. Or there are the environmentalists who say it comes from the stars, it comes from outside yourself. And there are many today who say personality is really a result of the influences of family, home, background, culture, and so on. Well, which is right? Are we sort of internally predestined by the chemistry of our bodies to be sanguine or phlegmatic? Or are we forced into a mold by our society? Moralists pictured people as sitting in the crossfire of good angels and bad, you know, one on each shoulder. Paul discusses the same thing, and he says there is this battle going on between the flesh and the spirit. Which is correct? How do we decide why people respond differently? I suspect that the reason that astrologers and fortune tellers and psychiatrists are so successful is that there is enough variety in us to make almost any diagnosis correct and any therapy effective. If you think of the present state of the art of psychology, it is really an infant science. We know so little about the human mind compared to what we know about the geology of the earth, for example. If we had spent as much time working on the human mind as we have on the physical parts of our body, we would know much more. But really, psychology is still in its infancy. We have to see it as a new science. And the reason there are so many psychologies, it seems to me, is simply that we are not yet far enough advanced to begin to reduce them to one or two that really seems to be accurate. And the fact is that we are so complex that almost any analysis fits a little bit of us and works in this or that case. Now the question is, of course, where do these selves come from? I suppose that what we call the selves within us are really simply ways of responding to the environment or to the outside world. Rural Howe recounts that he has asked many groups to do an exercise, which begins by completing the phrase, I am blank. Then you pick an adjective. I am fire. Well, he tries this with groups, and he says that he's completed the phrase himself, I am blank, along with the other participants, and that he's so far discovered over 300 adjectives that he could use about himself. Different slices, different dimensions of himself. But we are not 300 different people. Not even Rural Howe is 300 different people. We are somehow one. And when a personality loses that continuity, that selfhood, it disintegrates. And some of us have met people whose personalities have cracked, and they are no longer seemingly one person. Therein lies the mystery. How is it that we are both able to describe ourselves with 300 adjectives, many of them contradictory, and at the same time say, I? It's summed up for me in the phrase, I change. On the one hand, we seek unity as an expression of our identity over against the changing world. There's me, and I don't like the world to change too much. And our body, which we carry along with us all the time, reminds us that we're the same person. And our memory, which is a kind of interior biography, Both of those help us to unify ourselves and to remember that we are one person and remember the way we used to be and thus accept and integrate change. So we are one. On the other hand, we have also recognized that the essence of being human is adaptability, the opportunity to change, openness to the world of persons and things. And therefore, we somehow try to experience and see new possibilities. And as we do that, we often try to be more than we are. We try to take things into ourselves, and we are unable sometimes to do that, and we feel frustrated. We feel we are not realizing our potential. But we keep trying, and that makes us sometimes a problem to others around us, because we infringe on their turf or try to shape them to fit what we want ourselves to be. The old name for that was concupiscence, an effort to take more into ourself than we should. That what Herb Shellstrom was talking about last time, about more wants more. Well, this then brings us probably to the last and most difficult of the questions of humanity, and that is the question of evil. As I said, probably only human beings experience evil. As I've said, animals can experience pain and fear, but the judgment that these feelings are bad and could be avoided the judgment is made only by a being who can imagine that things might be different. The same capacity for imagining that things could be otherwise drives us to speculate why things are not otherwise. Why is there evil? And as human beings reflect on this problem, a wide variety of cultures have come up with several characteristics of evil that perhaps we can sketch briefly. First of all, evil seems to be transcendent. That is, it seems to be more than we can handle. It seems to be bigger than we are. A problem whose solution is not easily accessible. I have often quoted H.L. Mencken, who said that every problem has a solution that is quick, easy, and wrong. And the problem probably with many solutions to evil in the world is that it tries to make those quick, easy solutions. How does a culture express the fact that evil is transcendent? One way to do it is to say that evil comes from some particular god or race of supernatural beings who are beyond our control. And whether these are elves, gnomes, and leprechauns, or whether they are fallen angels, or some other mysterious black powers that reside in forests or under bridges or somewhere else, they are beyond our controlling. We can sometimes make deals with them. We can feed them or say little incantations. We can't control it. That's one way of saying that evil is transcendent, that it comes from outside. Another way is to say that evil started long ago. It's transcendent because we put it way back in the remote past, beyond the control of today. Now, the Bible uses both insights, both in terms of speaking about the Satan, for example, the adversary, or using the concept of the dragon or the devil, and at the same time in the story of the fall, which occurred before us, way back when, and thus put the world in a state where correction is not easily possible for us. Now, of course, this viewpoint is challenged today. A lot of people say that evil is not transcendent. Evil is simply in human beings. Hell is other people. And that the way you get rid of evil is education, soap and water maybe, better diet, psychotherapy. But I wonder if they are not confusing the perception of evil, which human beings certainly can display, with this broader concept of a transcendent, ineradicable problem in the world. The second character of evil relates to the first in one way, what I would call its personal nature. I could say that this element might best be described as the responsive nature of evil. That is, human beings note that evil seems to avoid our countermeasures. It seems to take advantage of hidden weaknesses, and just when we think we've got everything fixed, it hits us from the blind side. So for these reasons, they've often pictured evil over against us, like an opponent in some deadly game. We make this move, and we find ourselves caught or trapped. Naturally, if you think of evil in this way as somehow responsive in a negative way to our efforts, it's very easy to give rise to a rich mythology of evil, all kinds of evil beings of one sort or another, and we get the devils, the demons, the goblins, and all the things that the world has devised to try to describe this personal impression of evil. Now, of course, some people say, well, that's all wrong, and they try to depersonalize evil into some kind of natural force, or bad luck, or coincidence. But when they do that, they lose, it seems to me, the responsive nature that evil does indeed seem to present, and they make it into less than it really is. Finally, our perception of evil seems to be that it has bounds. There are no religions that I know of that assign evil a master's role. Evil is always seen as a perversion of the real, a temptation from the right path, an attack on the intended order of things, the work of a subsidiary god or godlet. And this means that somehow human perception of evil never accords it a kind of self-standing metaphysical basis. It can be overcome. It is somehow limited. But this limitation raises, of course, the last and most difficult question. If it can be controlled, if there is a limit to it, why is it not more effectively controlled? Who's in charge here? Why aren't the rules stricter? And then the problem of theodicy emerges. If God can do something about it, why doesn't he? And we're back to the limits of human discussion of that question. Well, we've come now to the end of the track I wanted to travel today. It's been a very difficult one in a sense for you, I'm sure. It's been hard for me to try to clarify some of these concerns, but let me just review the mysteries that are part of being human. One of them is we are a part of nature, and yet we are so different from it that we can control it, or at least respond to it in effective ways and change it and alter it. We are both dependent on it and transcendent. Then there is the riddle of self-consciousness. How do we know that there is a self, an us? It's the brain-mind question. Are we simply dependent on the brain, or is there a self behind it that transcends the physical equipment we have and uses that brain for deciding, for action? Then the question of self itself. When we talk about self-consciousness, who am I? Am I one? Am I many? Am I one which changes chameleon-like with the environment and the demands of the circumstances around me? What is it to be a self, and how constant is that self? And finally, the riddle of evil. I experience my world as a challenge. And this challenge is somehow beyond me, not controlled by me, yet somehow reactive to me. And I, though I believe it's limited, do not control it. And thus find in my world not only possibilities for growth, but also possibilities for danger and challenge and destruction. So I am once again dependent on this difficult force over against me, and yet I know it's limited. I can transcend and say someday it will be over, or there will be an end, or it does not pervade all of life. Caught between dependence and transcendence, we live our lives. To make sense of this is difficult. To endure it, however, is possible. Why? We get back to that creation story, it seems, with which we began. But the same God who has provided us with the ability to sense these problems about ourselves has, at the same time, provided us with the hope that through our relationship to Him, through the mind and the transcending elements within our physical makeup and our mental makeup, that we have a relationship which will one day clarify these mysteries and will one day make clear to us not only who we are, but where we have been and what this mysterious, puzzling, threatening, exciting, challenging experience we call life really has meant. It's my belief and faith that when we no longer see through the glass darkly, we will then look back and see this phase of our existence as clear and understandable, and we'll rejoice in the experience we have had as one of God's creatures in this most challenging and exciting universe. We've come again to the end of our time, and this was not a good session to leave without questions. But if you have a chance to talk to me about it, I'm willing to discuss it.
I'd like to make one comment, if I may. This week, it is now understood that there are 100 billion cells in the brain and not 10 billion.
Uh-huh.
So that your comment about change, if anything, I think you could emphasize that more.
Well, I've been away from the radio and all publications. What was it? 100?